Hello, everyone. It's Crystal here, one of your hosts for iAdsy891's podcast, Applebox Talks. It's been nearly 2 years since we released an episode of the podcast, and for many of us, a lot has changed in that time. Our industry, our people, have come through an incredibly challenging 2 years, and now we take stock of how we want to move forward with this work in the future. We're hoping to release Season 2 of Applebox Talks in 2025. Season 1 introduced you to some of the creative artists and technicians that make up the membership here and gave you a peek behind the curtain with our episodes focused on helping those new to the industry learn more about what it means to be a part of our local. In Season 2, we want to take a step back, looking more broadly at iAdsy891's role in both the motion picture industry and the greater labor movement here in BC. We're really excited about the upcoming interviews and the stories we will get to share with you in 2025. In the meantime, we've gone back to our archive and edited 6 previously unaired episodes from Season 1, and we'll be releasing those monthly for the rest of 2024. Since they were recorded in 2022, there are a few dated references, but there's still some excellent stories for you. So until we see you fresh again in 2025, pull up an Apple Box and let's talk. iAdsy891 presents Apple Box Talks,
the podcast where we get to talk to the very best in entertainment, the artists and technicians of iAdsy891.
From prep to post and everything in between, we create worlds on screens of all sizes. Welcome to Apple Box Talks. I'm Crystal.
And I'm Hillary. This week, we're joined by the department who make the monsters monstrous and the wounds look real, with credits to their names such as Predator, Look Who's Talking, and 6 Feet Under.
This week, taking their seat on the Apple Box is Todd Masters, special effects makeup artist. So pull up an Apple Box and let's talk. Welcome, Todd.
Thank you very much. It's a very uncomfortable Apple Box, I gotta say. Is there some sandpaper I might be able to... How's it going?
Good, good. Thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having me. This is fun. So where do we begin?
Let's start at the very beginning.
Okay. Well, my parents met. <No.
laughs> I love Sound of Music. So tell us what special effects makeup is exactly.
Exactly. Well, I don't know if I can get it exact. I mean, the whole point of what we do at Masters Effects is kind of to be weird. I mean, we do all the weird stuff, even some of the subtle weird stuff. So, for instance, we will create prosthetics to make an actor appear old or monstrous, like put an evil brow on him or a wicked nose, teeth, hair, whatever. Or we could go all the way to like a monster suit where we actually like... you know, shove an actor into a pre-made suit and they run around like, you know, kind of like the Star Trek Borg. They were like that. We don't really like limits, you know, so that's kind of the term special effects makeup and makeup effects and prosthetic effects and all these titles that kind of float around. They're fine, but it's difficult to actually get a word to describe every level of what we do because we touch into visual effects. We touch into prop effects, making props, costumes, all sorts of crazy stuff in our studios.
Including, and we worked on this show together, turning the Wayans brothers into white chicks.
Actually, I didn't do those makeups. I did I did everything else, but that was actually done by Greg Canham's team. But yeah, good old white chicks. I was actually just talking to one of those producers the other day, in fact, and having a little reminiscent of that film.
Yeah, I remember just the hours and hours and hours that they spent in the makeup chairs.
Crazy, spraying them and all that. I mean, those were pretty incredible makeups. I remember when I first saw the tests. I walked through the stage door when they were doing tests, and Marlon walked past me as a beautiful woman. I knew Marlon. I knew him pretty well, and I didn't recognize him at all. And in fact, I was like, well, who's the new person on set? You know, it was pretty funny. I mean, he actually made a pretty good lady.
And so talk to us about that then. So what is like the longest build you've ever had to do?
Well, I mean, in the old days, you know, because I've been doing professional film work since, you know, the early 80s, the old days, you know, it could be a whole variety of different things. It could be like a year of prep like we've had on some shows. It could be, you know, 5 hours into makeup. And there's all sorts of kind of metrics. Nowadays, we get more like weeks or even days. And so our team really has to be kind of very particularly focused. You know, we try to keep everybody on a project and really focus them and, you know, get it done in the time allowed. I mean, it's kind of TV schedules, really. And even features are turned into TV schedules because everything's on the tube now. Everything is pretty compacted. I can't quite think of the biggest, longest prep we've had, but, you know, I'd say about a year or so is probably the longest I think I've spent on a film.
How have changes in digital arts affected your craft?
Quite a bit. I'm from the pre-digital days. It's where I started, you know, in the 80s, where it was film and optical effects, we actually called them. And we were required because of that to do a lot more in front of camera, you know, trying to make the head melt, for instance, right there in front of you. And really required us to do a lot of different tricks, you know, almost like magic, sleight of hand type stuff. Because you kind of almost needed to have it happen, you know, before your eyes. We don't really do that as much, but we use those tools, what we learned from those eras, to apply to shots now, knowing that, you know, some of it may not actually appear on set, you know, and so having a good background in the practical, the pre-digital days has been really helpful. Nowadays, you know, a lot of practical makeup effects companies have been having trouble embracing visual effects. Some people think it's like, you know, us or them kind of situation. And it's really not. I mean, if you're going to progress in this industry, it really has to be kind of a handshake arrangement, you know, that we're going to do this part and you do that part and we somehow marry it together by design or conversation. And the shots are cooler now because we can really kind of finesse it in layers, and stuff that we couldn't do in front of camera, you know, the magic tricks, we're either able to do separately or maybe even render entirely digitally. So to me, I think it's really exciting. I mean, I'm not doing this because I love making rubber noses, you know. I mean, we make great rubber noses, but that's not what we're doing. I mean, we want to be filmmakers. We're film effects people. And to us, what ends up in the final product, you know, what scares you or makes you laugh or whatever is really what we're into. And it doesn't really matter how it's built. We just want that effect.
So where did you build an interest in your skills prior to getting into the film industry? Was there anything you did that kind of contributed to your...
I don't know how much I can tell. Okay, so when I was a kid, I was really into Ray Harryhausen and animation and Godzilla movies and all that kind of stuff. And I didn't really know how they were made, but I was just this crafty kid, and I discovered phone books, you know, like this. I lived in Seattle when I grew up, and the Seattle library actually had this amazing collection of phone books from around the world. And I found people in the phone book that I'd read in magazines that had done stuff like Ray Harryhausen, and he was actually in the phone book, believe it or not, on Ilchester Way or whatever. Not having any knowledge of time zones or anything, I would just call him up, and it was probably like 4 a.m. or something. Wow. And for some reason, he would answer, or his wife would, and there would be this, like, you know, she'd hold the receiver and you'd hear the stepping away, Ray, and he would jump on the phone. I don't know how many of, you know, me there was out there that he was answering these phone calls from, but he was great about that. Dick Smith was another one that I found in the phone book. Countless other people used to call Dick Smith too, because there was no books, there was no internet, there was none of this stuff. So we started, like, I started learning just by failing, you know, like calling people and just, you know, experimenting as a youngster. Then one day I looked in the phone book, you know, in Seattle where I lived, and I just looked under film production, and there happened to be this animation studio that I called up, and I had a really deep voice at 12 years old, and I said, you guys need any help or something? I don't know what I said, but I BS'd my way through it. And I took the bus like for 2 hours down to the worst neighborhood in Seattle and met these guys, which were hilarious, Tim and Dave Hill. I wish I could find them these days. And they were making cartoons, like, you know, 2D animation. You know, I had already made a couple of my own little Super 8 movies, and I showed my interest, and they believed that I wasn't 12. They thought I was, like, in college because I was this big kid, too. And they hired me. They hired me right off the bat, and they were just starting up on a birth control film. And so I was there painting sperm and hormones and all this stuff for a summer. And every night, you know, after I would come home, my parents were like, so, hey, what'd you do today? Oh, I painted 40 sperm, you know, or something like crazy like that. that. And they're just like, what is this job you're doing? And so by the time I was 13, I became department head over there. And, you know, eventually the job ended. And there was also a little lab in Seattle called Alpha Cine that kind of brought me in. I think they took pity on me because I was working at this crazy animation house. And I started working there. And I actually even touched Empire Strikes Back as it went through the lab. Wow. So it was kind of this really cool experience where I just quickly gained like all this knowledge. And so, you know, of course I was part-time in high school and stuff. So I had to do that too, and a job and all that business. But I managed to get enough skills that and develop a portfolio that I had something to show to the people in LA. And one of them said, well, hey, if you lived here, I'd hire you. And so I went, okay, I'm moving. And at 18, I, you know, moved to LA. And I think the first day I was in LA, one of those contacts that I had made hired me on Big Trouble in Little China. So I kind of started that way.
Who knew we were interviewing the Doogie Howser of the film industry?
Oh, crazy, right
now?
Oh, man, it's
13,
funny.
Managing. I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah, actually, my parents never told me about The Birds and the Bees, so I actually learned by making that educational film. So, that was my whole, yeah. So if anybody's out there going to date me, you're going to deal with cartoons.
So what drew you up to Canada, to the industry up here?
Well, as I say, I speak the language. No. I'm a dual citizen. My mom was born in Vancouver. She grew up in the Yukon. All sorts of fun stories about that. She met my dad in Seattle. They got married. 1970, I became a citizen. And I had this funny citizenship card from 1978 for the longest time until like a couple of years ago when it got stolen. And it had me with a bowl haircut and the whole thing. It's just really embarrassing. Anyway, I had an LA studio for quite a while. We actually just closed it down a couple of years ago because I was sick and I was just too busy with working up here. But our LA studio did really well for a long time. And then we got a couple shows in Toronto. And so I started commuting quite a bit and, you know, started realizing, oh, yeah, I'm Canadian. That's right. I forgot. And so started doing more and more stuff. Outer Limits and Stargate came along and they really needed somebody. So we started a little shop here, still building a lot of stuff in LA and shipping it. And then the shop here just grew and we found more people that were great and developed, you know, the staff. And all of a sudden, you know, here we are 35 years later at our company. And I don't know how that happened. So,
yeah. So you have Masters Effects.
Yeah.
So what does that side of it look like? Because that's the shop side of it, right?
That's our studio. Yeah. So that's the special effects, makeup and prosthetics company. We make animatronics, we make puppets, we make fake bodies and heads. We have a whole rental division, you know, because for doing this for so long, we've, you know, got great body molds and great babies. Everybody likes our babies because they're, they're easier to handle than real babies. We have fully, you know, animated babies that, you know, we can bring on set and they'll squirm around like real kids. We do a lot of skeletons, you know, in our rental department. We have pregnancy bellies. I mean, all sorts of stuff is in our rental department. Our custom side is, you know, more for the features that want us to make their specific monster or their specific age makeup or something like that. And so that's probably our busiest division. And then we, you know, we have an art department and a little visual effects department. And I've been getting more into production. I just co-produced a kids movie called Aliens Ate My Homework and the sequel, Aliens Stole My Body, which just actually won an Emmy for that.
Nice.
We just wrapped a Bruce Willis film here in town that we also co-produced, and we've got a whole bunch of others coming down. So that's kind of where we want to take it, is actually, you know, making our own weird stuff, you know, beyond just the rubber and the monster suits. Let's make weird movies.
You mentioned specific monsters, and you can't get much more specific than Predator. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Sure. Predator was one of the earlier films. I'm talking like the 1987 original Predator. One of the early films I worked on, I think just a couple after Big Trouble in Little China. That show came through the shop I was working at. That was Boss Films Company at the time. And this young guy named Jean-Claude Van Damme came through the shop, and he had no idea that we were going to, you know, cover him in monster suits and put him in big, long leg extensions. I don't think he was too happy about that. I was actually more focusing on the effects. Like if you remember the film, there's a scene where Jesse Ventura's chest blows open and the weapon flies through. That was one of my tricks. Carl Weathers gets his arm blown off. I worked a lot on that. Shane Black is in the film, who actually directed the more recent The Predator. He's in the original one because he was chasing Joel Silver around with his Lethal Weapon script. So Joel just said, ah, put that guy in the movie, so he stops bugging me. And so Shane's in the movie as a dead, he's a live guy, but he also ends up as a dead guy. So I made that. And when we actually did the more recent The Predator and Shane was directing, he came by the studio and we talked about all that. And I actually told him that he was in the second Predator more than he is in the first one. And he didn't know what I was talking about. And it's actually his dead body is like all through the second film. And I don't know if he ever got residuals for that. But anyway, what else? So yeah, it was kind of that stuff. The show eventually, I think, is probably well known, shut down because they actually did not like Jean-Claude Van Damme in the monster suit. That was not working. And so it shut down for a few months and came back up with another company doing the monster suit. So all the stuff I did on the show is actually in the movie. But the monster suit that Boss Films created, Jean-Claude Van Damme got butchered. There's actually, if you remember the rippling effect, you know, when the camouflage effect. A lot of that is actually the Jean-Claude Van Damme suit still in the movie, just because they had shot it as a composite suit.
Is there any particular monster you're fond of?
I love my parents. Those are great monsters. You know, to us, it's art and commercial art at that. And we do get attached to it. It's kind of funny when artists and myself get attached to these things because they're not real, right? They're just latex and plastic. But we actually do kind of get weirdly attached to it. Our rental guy, Eric, is awesome about this because he's named all our rentals. I have all these names. I just asked him the other day, did you name any of these Todd yet? And he goes, no. I'm like, good. Don't, because I'm afraid I'm going to get like beaten up or something. But he actually is very attached to all the rentals. We just had a show out in Halifax destroy a whole bunch of our stock just in the course of making the movie. And that was a sad day for her, I think. So, yeah. You know, so anyway. But yeah, we do get kind of this weird, you know, we want them to actually evoke emotion, you know, to make them real characters, because that's really what we're making is characters. They have to have that twinkle in the eye. They have to have that touch of God. So they are kind of relatable and lovable and not in a weird way.
How do you do that? How do you put that touch of God into a piece?
Tricky, isn't it? And you know when it's not there. I mean, you've probably seen the fake heads and you've probably seen the fake dummies in the movies and all that. It pops, you know.
Literally
you
have a fake head right behind me here.
He doesn't look fake. Oh. Okay. Well, that's an example, right?
Yes.
So that's not kind of, you know, what they throw that term around, the uncanny valley. And all of that is really trying to say, you know, do we relate to it as a believable organic thing, or are we bumping on it and it's like somehow we don't know, but somehow it's synthetic to us and we're not really connecting to it. So that is the skill of our great artists. They bring the touch of God with them every day to work. You know, some of them have reached that level in a way that'll just blow your mind. You know, like we obsess about like eyebrows. I'm looking at your eyebrow right now, by the way. But you know what I mean? It's like if your eyebrow is off, it's so, since it carries so much of your personality, you're going to pick that up. You know, monsters, maybe not so much because you haven't really seen a whole bunch of those, but human faces, it's definitely something that requires, you know, all these little subtle things. You know, the eye has to look right, has to have depth to it. You know, the lashes need to all be there. All the little freckles, all those little blemishes, you know, we want that. So, because it brings it to life and it makes it actually feel organic and believable. And, you know, hopefully the twinkle and the touch of God. So you're completely fooled. You know, that's the whole magician's thing. You got to be fooled.
So research must play a huge role in what you do, especially when you're curating a collection of these things to rent out. How do you edit what you take in?
That's a great question. Wow. I mean, obviously, I have a lot of hats, but one of my big ones is getting images in and trying to see what other artists are doing. You know, like Instagram's amazing for that. We all like obsess of all these great artists that are all over Instagram that maybe y'all aren't so familiar with, but we get nuts about how like this sculptor is in Greece and he's like phenomenal. How is he in Greece? You know, like all this stuff. Like we think we're so good because we focused on it so furiously for so many decades, but there's people out there in the Instagram Instagram world or whatever the platform, that are just doing just spellbounding stuff. And so, yeah, we suck all that up and we scour Google, and I've got a bunch of crazy books, and, you know, we soak it all in. We want to know it all. So when a director has a reference, oh, yeah, I know that one. You know, so you can pick it up. It could be new. It could be old. It could be random. But we try to get it all kind of in the noggin.
So we spoke to an editor earlier where we were talking about the good for something box, where you've created something that doesn't necessarily get used.
Yes,
so is there a closet somewhere that's just full of heads and hands and monster parts that we need to know about?
I think that's the rental department. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, editorial is slightly different because they're putting together a linear thing that, you know, requires the occasional patch or influence or something. So I can totally see why they would use that. We're a little different in that we get it all out. Like right now we're making this really cool monster, and the team that we have, like, four sculptors on it, and they're all just, you know, really talented, and each one of them is checking out what the other one's doing and influenced by it, and just develops before your eyes into this stuff. And it's, I mean, I've been doing this for my entire life and I'm still blown away by it. You know, it's still really cool watching art develop like that.
Is there a certain material that you always find yourself coming back to that might surprise our listeners?
Sex toys. We actually use a lot of sex toys, and I'm not kidding. There is a specific material that one of our guys actually was involved in developing down in LA, and it's really flexible. It's really supple. It's unlike silicone. It's unlike rubber, and it's pretty damn cool. We don't use it for the sex parts. We chop them up and melt them down. And it actually makes for great membranes and all sorts of weird crap. So
must be a fun time submitting those invoices to accounting.
We had a day. there was one point during Slither, if you ever saw Slither, but Slither's got just a ton of sex toys in there, and it all melted down. Of course, you can't, like, see, I mean, even though the designs are kind of, you know, the whole subplot of the film was kind of deviant sex, so we kind of subtly put it into the concepts and designs and surprised the director with it in some respects, even though he wrote it in the script. He didn't quite realize we got it all. And that show, because of all the big blobs and monsters, if you've seen the film, you know what I'm talking about. It's a huge practical effects show. We had so much of that material that makes sex toys that we ran out, not just locally, but globally. We actually went to the base chemist and they said, no, the material to create that is gone. We need more of it. I think it was during one of the Iraq wars or something. So they were having a hard time getting, you know, the petroleum product. So that show used it all up. So we sent the runner out to go buy a bunch of sex toys. She's like, go to every sex store in LA now. You know? And he came back with a huge pile of these things, and they poured them all out on a gigantic table and started chopping them up. And so, of course, this is the time that I'm walking clients through and we're talking about a new project, and we walk right by this table, and, like, you know, there's so much weird stuff in our studio, it's kind of hard to, like, oh, that's weirder than this one, you know. And so this was a little odd. It took me a double take, but we literally, like, walked by this gigantic pile of penises and vaginas that they were chopping up, and the client just was like, what the hell kind of company are you guys? To me, it was just another day.
I've never been happier with a question I've asked in a podcast.
Well, I'll try to beat that one.
You mentioned something that really resonated with me. So my grandfather used to run around with a big 16 mil film camera.
And 16 millimeter, yeah.
That's what all of my family's home videos are.
Awesome.
It's 16 great. Mil and some Super 8. And cool. They say that Super 8's like one of the closest images to memory.
Who says that? Dr. Bolshevik?
Could be, maybe. Do you think having been exposed to film at that young age is part
of why? Completely screw me up. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to jump on your question there.
Nope, that was totally
fine. Are you saying, do you think that influenced my...
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, my dad had an 8mm camera. I broke it and I ruined a bunch of his home movies. And I was so, I mean, I still think about it today. It's like, holy crap, why did I do that? But I was a dumb kid, right? And I was like, oh, let's take this apart and see how it works. I don't know how it goes back together, whatever. You know? And so, yeah, I think, especially that experience, I think kind of burnished this whole career in my head. And I've always enjoyed entertainment, and it made sense to me. Film production made sense to me as a kid, even. And I actually used to make my book reports as little Super 8 movies because I didn't want to write. I just wanted to make a movie.
So we asked you in your pre-interview, what do you think your department's motto would be? Do you remember what you said?
I don't remember, no.
You said, leave a good-looking corpse and don't forget to bill for it.
Yeah, that's definitely me, yes. So I think you got the right guy.
This might be a bit of a left field kind of question, but generally speaking, from a North American context, death is not something that people talk about a lot. And it's something a lot of people have a lot of discomfort with. How do you address that when you have to create visually a dead body or a dead body part?
It's really tricky because all of us experience death in one way or the other. Eventually we're going to experience it firsthand. So everybody has... You know, I hate to call it baggage, but I guess it is about death and, you know, all that stuff. So you have to be really careful. I made a mistake once on Six Feet Under, and the pilot of Six Feet Under, talking to the show creator, Alan Ball, I actually showed him real reference. And, you know, I'm thinking like, well, this guy wrote this like really hardcore show. I mean, he obviously respects what's going on. So why would he be weird about photos? And I showed him photos of a car accident. And he just kind of like looked at me wooden and just kind of walked away without saying anything. And later on, an assistant came up to me and says, you know, his sister, I think, had an accident. You don't really want to do that. And it was a big lesson because you're right. I mean, I don't know what people have gone through. I have to be really careful about showing real stuff because it hits a chord. And in the movie business or TV world, you don't necessarily, you want to hit the chord, but you don't necessarily want to supply a completely believable situation in those respects because, A, they're kind of unbelievable looking. They're so horrific that you have a hard time believing it. So you don't really want to duplicate, you know, if you look at all these horrible books that we have of real death, it's awful. It makes your stomach turn. And even people that have done it for decades. So we have learned, you know, out of that experience and others to do more concepts, show them art, even if it's based on something real. Our film people, our designers, we all know how to kind of translate for the story. I mean, it's storytelling ultimately. So you do not want it to be negative storytelling, which is what I did to Alan accidentally. Got his mind going in the wrong direction. And you don't want to do that in a linear story. You want to kind of make sure that it, you know, amplifies the message of the show and doesn't distract, which was really interesting to learn on Six Feet Under because not just that experience, but every episode was so heartfelt and it was all about getting the emotions. And so it was something that we didn't want them to ever be working on special effects, right? We never wanted the bodies, you know, because there's tons of fake bodies in that show. You know, it's kind of the body of the week show, we used to say. We never wanted any of our effects to look like effects or even really good effects. We wanted our stuff to just look like it belonged in a forensic world, you know, in a pathological lab where they're doing this stuff. These guys are, you know, the characters are working on cars more or less. You know, that's really kind of what this is to them. And so we definitely want to make sure that we don't have any of those things, you know, I just mentioned bump the audience because it won't work for the rest of the show. And the whole show is about this stuff.
Have you ever said, nope, not doing that?
Yeah. There was this really big show I really wanted to do. Well, there's a couple different reasons we would say no. I don't like doing just outrageously gory stuff for the sake of gore. I don't think that really belongs in the entertainment world. That's me. That's my opinion. So I avoid, you know, overly gratuitous, hack me up shows if I can. We also sometimes are just too busy. Like we have a few things going on right now in the Burnaby studio. We also have a Toronto studio. And there was this great project with a great director that I really, really wanted to do. And it was just kind of wall-to-wall effects. And so I was like, oh, let's do this. And they kind of had a little pause in the action. I think they were waiting for a script or something. And so there was like 2 weeks where we were just kind of like, are we going to do this? Are they not going to hire us? What are we going to do? And we got like three other projects that just dropped in. And so after 2 weeks, that one show that I really wanted to do, the director that I really liked, he called up and says, hey, we're ready to go. And I'm like, oh, no. And I had to turn them down, but I think they've got some other people that are really great, so it should be fine. But yeah, there's definitely reasons to turn down stuff. I mean, if you don't connect with material, it's weird just to do a job in our business. You know, we're all sorts of into crazy art. We really want to bring something to the project.
So how do you build your team when you're looking to expand or find new talent for a specific project? How do you do that?
Another great question. It's not easy because we look for people that have an extremely unique skill, and it's oftentimes not something that they've learned from a school. There are makeup schools, and we definitely scour them. We have a little intern program with one of the local makeup schools looking for new talent. You know, a lot of students these days, you know, they have the question, should I get into CG work, you know, visual effects work, or should I get into makeup effects, practical effects? So it's an interesting decision for some of them, I think, because, you know, they look at the future and they're worried that maybe there won't be as much work in makeup effects or practical effects. And, you know, I think over the years we've seen that, you know, practical effects definitely still has a place. So it's great to still see some fresh talent coming in, especially ones that surprise me, because, you know, it's very easy for fresh talent to kind of just do the same old zombie or the same old this or that. I've seen a couple lately that are pretty damn good. And Vancouver does have a good selection of artists. We definitely tap out pretty fast. You know, it's like it's a very specific skill, so it's not like every artist can do it. So the best ones are usually working like all the time. And we also develop talent. The schools are great, but oftentimes by working like hands-on with real schedules and real pressure and real materials, we can find some people that are really good at this stuff. Like there's couple people we brought in recently that didn't come from this world at all, and they brought skills from another industry, and we're all just like, wow, these people are great. So we're always kind of looking for fresh talent and you know, good personalities, people that are good to work with. That's also very important.
And a certain level of comfort around sex toys, obviously.
That actually does not come up. I don't think that's part of the interview. But,
sorry.
So, Todd, if you could work with any filmmaker that you haven't yet, who would that be and why?
Jeez. Do they have to be living? I mean, I love old movies, so I'm like always fascinated, like Billy Wilder and Ernest Lubitsch and Ida Lupino. I'd love to work with her. I'm on this whole Mae West thing right now because she had a bunch of movies just come out on Blu-ray and she was just phenomenal. So I'd like to work with Mae West, actually. Can I have that?
Maybe in a few years' time.
Yeah, maybe. Hey, Mae. Who knows? What up? No, modern filmmakers are actually, it's interesting, the ones that, you know, the industry and maybe entertainment business touts as, you know, the superstars, you know, like the Chris Nolans, the Ridley Scotts and the Spielbergs and all that. A lot of those folks, the Guillermo del Toros, you know, a lot of these folks really understand what we do and really use practical effects and sometimes use it to lead shows. And you'll notice you'll get different textures out of these filmmakers. You know, if you look at the Fish movie that Guillermo del Toro just did, you know, it's like you couldn't do that with a CG character. There's subtle CG enhancements, but the performance, the fact that they would be able to embrace, what is the name of that movie?
Touch of Water?
No. The Shape of Water.
Shape of Water? Okay, yeah, great film. And you really, at least I did, when I watched it, I was in that world. And I think there is some beautiful digital work out there now, and a lot of it, you don't bump on it. But even if it's just like a subtle thing, like an eyebrow being out, sometimes you do bump on digital stuff. And so a real generous balance, I think, is good. Personally, I get CG narcolepsy when I watch like big Marvel shows and stuff like that. Yeah. At the ending when the city's exploding, which always happens, and it's just like particles everywhere, I fall asleep. I can't handle it. It's just too much.
So. You keep mentioning eyebrows and looking at my eyebrows. I'm a little self-conscious now.
I'm sorry. No, it's not that it's at all. Okay. But yeah, take care of that. No.
You don't have nice eyebrows.
I actually ran out of eyebrow pencil this
really?
Morning.
Really? I was just really using it as a detail. It wasn't meant to be personal.
You do have nice eyebrows. Too, by the way. Yeah.
So, The Shape of Water, Doug Jones is famously a man who is often seen with prosthetics. Could you talk a little bit about the working relationship of a makeup special effects artist with an actor, given that so often you're covering their face or covering their hands?
Yeah, it can be tricky. Doug is an exception. I mean, he is so much part of the monster team when he does a project that he's almost the lead of it. And not in a negative or demanding way. He's very comfortable to be around. He's had so much stuff done. He understands more than what we do than we do. And, you know, he's just so pleasant and generous to be around. We actually did a commercial together, his first thing, 86, I think it was. It was the big Mac Tonight McDonald's campaign. Doug was Mac Tonight, and it was like, I think it might have been his first show. And so we kind of started off then, and then I didn't see him for a long time. And then we did a show up here called Falling Skies, and we were on season 3 of that. And they just wanted to introduce this new character called Cochise, and they were talking about having him all digital. And so I'm like hearing this, like, to me, that sounds like by episode 3, he turns invisible, you know, because that's usually how they deal with budgets. You know? I was like, well, let's just deny it. Let's not see it. And so I knew Doug really well, and I actually just sent him a note and like, hey, Doug, are you by chance available? Because I've got a part for you that is just totally you. And that was Cochise. And we offered Doug up to the showrunner, who did know who he was, because Doug's kind of, you know, especially back then, he was kind of one of those hidden superstars, you know. And so this Craig Beeman's eyebrows raised. He's like, we can get Doug Jones? And everybody else is like, who's Doug Jones? Who's Doug Jones? And Craig's like, he's going to be the most famous actor on this show. And they're all like, what? And sure enough, you know, he is the well-known person from that, even though if he's covered in lots of rubber. You know, he brings a performance out of that stuff, which is a real rare talent. Not even professional creature suits, for the most part, know how to do what he does. And so that's one exception. On the other side, you have actors that don't understand what we do, and they do feel like they're being covered up, or they're being muffled if we're using dentures, or you know, shoving shit in their eyes or something. So it's a tricky relationship. You need to understand what they're looking for out of the character, hopefully support it. You know, you obviously don't want to go against the grain, because they eventually have to drive the makeup, if it's a makeup or a suit or whatever. So it is a very specific artist that can wear like the big stuff, like the suits and stuff. And it's a very specific character conversation we need to have with either the director or the cast member, depending on what the situation is. And hopefully they're all down with it. The old days, we would just show up the morning of and glue the makeup on. They would have no idea what face it was until it was finished. Nowadays, we do like Photoshop concepts, and we will show the director and the producer and oftentimes the actor where we're headed with it, so they can, you know, be involved early. Because we don't want to do what we used to do. We'd show up and like, hey, here's a piece of rubber we're going to stick on your face. Be a character now. You know, we want them to develop the character with us and really make something that's going to, you know, work. Like, you know, like the White Chick situation, you know. Those are makeups that were done a few times to make sure they were right. It's a tricky negotiation, and we're always interested in trying to figure that out with cast members.
So you obviously have a deep breadth of experience and training in various areas. If you were to recommend, IATSE obviously has a whole host of training suites for different departments, but if someone's listening and they want to get into makeup effects, is there a specific course that you would recommend they take to familiarize themselves a little bit more?
I would recommend the Stan Winston School. It's an online course that Stan, who was one of our leading geniuses of monster making, he passed away about 10 years ago. His son took it over. You know, like instead of like furthering the makeup shop, they said, well, we're going to take everything that Stan and the company had learned and developed, and pretty much the industry, what they've learned, and we're going to put it online with how-to videos. And so they started off looking for individual artists that could speak about painting or mold making or sculpting or animatronics. And they, you know, it's been going on for, you know, since Stan passed away, and it's really become quite his legacy of all this education that goes into new artists, you know, that are eager for this, that don't have a place to go. It's there for you. You know, it's not terribly expensive. If you really think about how much a makeup school would be, you have to learn yourself. You have to motivate yourself to learn, but it's all there, and it's all by people that do it professionally in film, and it's phenomenal. So that's the Stan Winston School, and I'm not being paid to say that.
I would assume you'd also need to know how to do beauty makeup, because if you're working on dead bodies or bodies that may have been just recently, you know, I don't know, maybe they're sleeping, maybe they're in a coma, maybe, you know, you'd still need to know how to do beauty.
Well, I mean, the arts are pretty broad, right? I mean, we have illustrators, we have painters, we have sculptors, you know, yada, yada, yada. Like, some of them don't do beauty makeup. You know, like, some of our best prosthetics artists don't really touch into that. Some of them do, and that's pretty phenomenal. like myself, I was a crappy makeup artist in terms of like trying to make a beauty makeup. I could do really good prosthetics, but you know, all my beauty makeups always look like drag queens. It's really bad at it, but it's just not my thing. I don't have that loaded in my head. I'm actually working on a show right now where we're really studying dynamic beauty makeup and line style. And you know, I love the design of it. You know, it's not really my focus. My focus is to try to, you know, kind of be a very specific generalist, if I may. And it's usually more on, you know, the monsters or replicating, you know, organic something.
So when people think about special effects makeup, they do first think about monsters or horror or an arm falling off. But is there a genre that might surprise our listeners that you find yourself working in regularly as a special effects makeup artist?
Sure. Like, you know, The Good Doctor is a good example. Fifth season going on right now, a procedural show about surgeries. Every single episode has quite a lot of makeup effects in it, and very few of them are evident. And we just finished a show with cancer victims, did a bunch of bald caps on that to believably sell that storyline. Like I said, our babies are all over the screen right now. And if they're done well, you shouldn't know if it's an effect. So there's quite a bit of that. I mean, we've made all sorts of fake stuff just to kind of be there for whatever reason. Like we did a body for The Sixth Sense once that I can't even spot in the show. So, you know, part of it is to be invisible. You know, there is a side of us that is flamboyant and pink colors and glitter monsters. You know, we can do some crazy stuff, but it's, you know, it's all whatever the show's tone is, what the show's palette would be, you know, what's acceptable in their narrative. Because I'm not going to do glitter monsters on 6 feet Under, for instance. True Blood, maybe, but not 6 feet
Glitter monsters. What's a glitter monster?
I have no idea. Just made that up. Sounds kind of cool.
I want to see it.
Yeah. I'm going to copyright that right here. But yeah, that'd be kind of cool. Like this evil disco monster with thick boots.
I love it. And drag queen makeup.
Well, it's like glitter. It's like a virus, you know? It's like if you get a can of glitter, it like follows you everywhere. You know?
Yes, like it sure does.
Get that little teeny glitter.
Someone described it to me as the herpes of art supplies.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly right. That's a good way to put it. We actually do not use a lot of glitter. That's just an example.
I think you've touched on something that's come up time and time again with these interviews, is that everything about this is collaboration, and that it really requires everybody doing their part as part of a moving, almost living and breathing organism.
That's where the film industry works best, is when we're all, I mean, that's kind of what the point of a union is in some respects, to kind of join us and bring us together. I mean, I know at times there's conflicts and we break apart. I think the union's also here for that too. But it's, you know, we work on so many different projects. You know, sometimes we just do a little teeny thing for a huge project, and other times we do huge things for a small project. We see them all. We see all sorts of different types of show running, all sorts of types of organization. Whereas, you know, most production people, they do one show, they wrap it, then they do another show, they wrap it. You know, we're doing like 10 things at once, at least. And we get to see how each nucleus operates. And it's fascinating between, you know, Zoom meeting to Zoom meeting, how different they are and what the results are. And kind of the madness that ensues in some shows. But the ones that work best together are the ones that are mellow, that listen, they're experienced, they're skilled, and they're a believer of collaboration, because we cannot do it by ourselves. Like, I need all my people at Masters Effects. Every single one of them has their place and does some amazing stuff, and we couldn't have done it without them. And same thing with our industry. You know, we have great artists out there. We need to get them to do their work that they do best, you know, support them to whatever extent to make better films, and you're going to get a better product.
What's the next skill you'd like to learn?
Well, you know, like I said, I've been getting more into producing and filmmaking. I've been working on my writing. I just turned in a whole crazy script thing for this thing I'm supposed to be directing soon. They gave me the script and I kind of went, I don't know about it. And so they said, well, you can do anything you want. And I went, what, really? So I wrote what I wanted, and so far it looks good. So that's kind of one area. I mean, I've been directing and making my own stuff for a long time. I have not directed a feature yet, like a first unit, like the whole damn thing. And I don't want it to be crap, you know, I want it to be cool. So I just don't want to direct, you know, whatever script lands on my lap unless it's kick-ass. And so that's something I'm getting into. I also, I'm really researching green plastics and how we can be a cleaner company. I would love it if the film business in whole did that, because we are production, but we're also destruction. And we are very bad for the environment, especially my studio. I mean, studios like Makeup Effects, we use a lot of plastics. We use a lot of just crap, dirty garbage. So we've been, you know, for the last many years, we've been really working hard on figuring out ways around that. How can we get rid of some of these more noxious chemicals that not just cause waste, but, you know, hurt us? So that's been a big focus. I've been focusing on nutrition a lot because I'm concerned, you know, there's quite a bit of stuff going on right now, of course, with the union down south wanting to strike and all that. And it's all about hours and our health and stuff like that. And so I've been looking at the other side, which is, you know, us. You know, I screwed my body up for years making movies with crazy hours and eating crap food and drinking soda and all the stuff that we know we shouldn't be doing. And, you know, I went through some serious health stuff because of it. And I don't want my people to follow that, even though it's so easy to do when we're working at fast pace, you know, like, oh, let's just get a drive through, you know, it's fucking killing us. We really need to be smarter about how we use our body, especially if we're using it like an instrument, you know, like we are loaded with skills going on a film set to do a skilled job. And if we're half there, or if we're destroying ourselves as we're doing these skills, it's really not a great plan. It's not very sustainable for the industry or for us. So working on that too.
Yeah, I can relate to that. Right? Yeah, absolutely.
Well, none of us were told how to eat. You know, how really. I mean, yeah, we had the triangle, you know, the old food triangle. Mm-hmm. But it's so hard to find real food now. I mean, it is nearly impossible to find like an organic apple within, I don't know, a couple kilometers from here. And fast food and garbage crap and soda pop and all that, it's everywhere. And so we need to learn how to work in this world and do better for ourselves.
Now that you're the person that would be in the phone book that somebody would be looking up, if those existed, if you picked up the phone and young Todd was on the other end of the line, what would you say?
Well, these days I think it's done through social media. I seem to get a lot of that on social media. I actually do enjoy hearing from people out there and seeing what they're into. If it was like a young artist trying to figure out how to develop their skills, if I have the time, I'd be happy to do that because someone helped me.
So what piece of advice would you give them?
Become a lawyer. I'm kidding. You don't want to do that. Well, I absorb, you know, I mean, learning is about absorbing, doing and failing and repeating. And so there's a great Winston Churchill quote. Let's see if I can pull it up. The secret to success is to consistently exist through failure without losing motivation. I think it is something like that. I mean, he had this great quote. I think I just butchered it. But he had this great quote that was essentially learn how to fail. You know, that's the best thing you can do in life is learn how to fail, because you will fail. And if it destroys you, you know, if your failure is like, ah, man, and just, you know, it discourages you from trying it again, maybe don't do this job. You know, so you really need to have kind of an open mind, a skill set, a personality that's, you know, willing to work with other people and maybe learn from other people and do it again and do it again and do it again until it's, you know, what is that, the 10,000 hour thing that Malcolm Gladwell used to talk about? You know, you're not a, was it mastering? I think it was mastering, actually. If in 10,000 hours, you can master something. It's true. I mean, if you actually spend approximately 10 years on something, you're going to be damn good at it. So that's kind of what the skill is, and you just have to learn a lot of them. So you need to be very old. Kidding.
Well, thank you for your contribution to this industry as a whole.
Oh, and thanks for saying that.
And for our membership. as you've mentioned, you have your effect shop here and in Toronto, and you know, it sounds like there's been a lot of training ground for folks moving into this department. So
I would think so. Yeah. I mean, it's not just me, of course, there's other great shops, but I think Canada's got an amazing group of filmmakers, and I love shooting in Canada. So
that was fantastic. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Todd.
And that's a wrap for another episode of Apple Box Talks.
For more episodes and to find your fit in the film and TV industry, check out ourwork.ca.